Welcome to Pivot Spokane on the Bookshelf. Tonight we'll hear the final personal stories on the subject of promises. This was from a presentation on November 2nd at the Washington Cracker Building. Tonight's three stories are Jennifer Hawkins with the ever-changing promise of raising a child, Moira Ruiz with the promise and peril of emigrating to a land of opportunity, and concluding with Daniel Walters on the ever-precarious promise of love. Here's the Pivot host, Eric Wittard.
Our first storyteller tonight is going to be Jennifer Hawkins.
So, of course, tell you a story. So, I just dropped my son off at the University of Washington for his freshman year, and they have this amazing swing there. And I don't know if you've ever been on the campus, but the swing is made for three. And it's this beautiful wood bench with these awesome poles instead of links. And then at the top, there's this gorgeous red arch. And I love swings, so of course I couldn't help myself. Sat down and began to swing. And of course, you have the butterflies in your stomach, and I'm swinging up, and you swing back, just like life. And I began to think about the little boy that made it all the way to Seattle. Ryan is 7 years younger than his sister Veronica, and Ronnie was easy, frankly. She took 3 days to deliver, but other than that, her temperament was amazing. And she always had her nose in a book, was really easy. My husband and I had her when we were really young, and life was great. And then we were pregnant with Ryan, and my due date comes along, and I'm thinking, there is no way in hell I'm doing that again. 3 days? Forget it. So the morning of my due date, I go down to the grocery store and I buy two things, castor oil and grape juice. Now, I want you to picture me naked, 9 months pregnant, standing over the sink, huge as a whale, like this. Oh my God, and I'm drinking it and I'm trying not to vomit. Well, it worked. And the very next day, I had a beautiful baby boy. And it seemed like it would be wonderful, right? Well, easy labor and delivery, easy pregnancy, not so easy when I brought him home. Ryan had severe colic and he ended up with an upper respiratory disease and all kinds of different illnesses. And he ended up in Sacred Heart Hospital for 2 months. And that wasn't so bad, right? We rebuilt his immune system, got him back on track, things seemed great. Fast forward to eighth grade. Veronica's already graduated, again, my easier one. Ryan, on the other hand, he's doing well too, but he's way more vocal than she is, by far. But we've just finished going to an award ceremony for him where, you know, it's the end of eighth grade, he's getting academics and leadership awards and all kinds of different things. Life is good. My husband and I, we're doing great. I've just been 6 months at the blood center with a new position, and my husband has been promoted as quality director, and he's traveling to Connecticut for training. And while he's in Connecticut, he gets a phone call. His mom has had a heart attack. So he flies to San Diego, and on his way home, unfortunately, she passes away. And so we're pretty overcome with grief. And in the meantime, Ryan's really sick, unusually sick. June 17th, 2013, a couple of days after eighth grade is over, Ryan is diagnosed with leukemia. That's the swing of life, right? You're up, and then you're down. And those were hard times, and I will tell you, I could tell you the story of his cancer, right? Cancer sucks, and it's hard. And trying to keep it all together while we battle chemo and radiation and a bone marrow transplant, that was hard. But that's not the part that I want to tell you about. What I really want to talk about is the promise. Because as a parent, you think you're doing everything right, right? You've figured it all out. You've got control. You make a plan. You think about what your child will be like, and you plan it all out, what they'll look like, how they'll act, what kind of parent you want to be. But I know better, right? Because that's the swing. Now we're over here. And as I'm sitting on that swing, back and forth, I can't help but sob as I think about what we've been through. And so here's the moral of the story. Really, be present, because today is a good day, and you don't know what tomorrow may bring. So fight like hell, love like hell, and give it all you got.
Thank you, Jennifer. That was wonderful. That was, wow, that's a tough act to follow. We're going to go from one promised land that didn't necessarily feel so promised to another promised land that maybe also didn't feel so promised. Please welcome Mara Ruiz.
I work with different students. These students have a lot of things in common. I have a lot of things in common with them. I was born in Mexico, brought here at the age of 2. I have refugee students from Burma, from Thailand. They know how to speak all sorts of languages. My parents tell me that they came to this country for a better life, to seek the dream, something that we all try to seek. And it's interesting because my mom was married and she, after one too many kicks in the head, kicks in the stomach from abuse, met my father, who brought us to this country. They say I came here with my 2 older siblings, with a coyote, which is a person that comes and charges you a lot of money to cross the border, while my mom crossed in the hillside of Tijuana all the way up to California. And it took her 8 days to cross the border. 8 days of running through the rivers, through the mudslides, huddling down under cars, waiting until the rain was done pouring so they could figure out where to go to next to hide from La Migra. We crossed with papeles chuecos in a van. Papeles chuecos are a form of papers that they give from American kids. I was a boy that day. My earrings got taken away and I was dressed in boy clothes. And my mom tells me that after she crossed the border, she went into a house where she was forced to cook and clean for the coyote in order for my dad to pay her what she thinks is $700, but what my dad truly says is $3,500 in order for us to get here. But he boasts that he came legally. So he came through the migrant working program, and he says through him, we all became citizens. So, thank you, Dad. How this relates to my students is because they have similar stories. The theme of isolation comes from my student, D. And he was forced to work in a refugee camp with his dad, cutting down trees, in order to make sure that the rest of his siblings had enough money to eat and get by. The feeling of hopelessness that comes from my student Moo when she says her first day of school, nobody understood her. The feeling of isolation that comes with Christina, the student who talks about how her dad worked endless days and nights and she would never see him because he was too busy saving patients and he now works at the casino as maintenance. The feeling of helplessness and fear that comes from my student Tatiana, who hid her and her siblings in a closet as her mom was dealing with cocaine and drugs and using that and avoiding fights in her living room over drugs. We all had a bad background, but that is how we relate. We are all in search of the American dream. I tell them, I will take you as far as you'd like to go. I tell them I'm your mentor, I'm your friend. I'm here for your highest highs and your lowest of lows.
And what resonates with me the most is all those feelings into one. Because we may not have had a good life in Mexico, but it didn't stop once we crossed the border. We were raised by part in a van because we lived by a crazy psycho who would throw out our beans out into the street and flatten our tires until my dad beat him up and he ran away. And our next house was with somebody that my parents met in a hop field. And my sister was molested by their older child, so we left that place. Again, our home was in a van, in the back seat where there was a cushion. I remember also feeling hopeless because we had no food. And I remember my mom asking my brother to ask his teacher from Epic to give any leftovers to the family. And he would run up the hill with his bag of burritos, and that's what we would have for supper. And then I remember living the American dream when we got our first trailer. I remember the feeling of isolation when my parents had to go work and we had to stay in the trailer and my mom would say, don't open the door to anyone because they will come and take you. So she bought us Nintendo video games, which I wasn't allowed to play because my brother would hog them all the time. I wasn't allowed to go out and play in the basketball hoop until she got home after 3. So my promise to my kiddos was that despite them not knowing how to get there from high school, I would get them there to college because we're all in search of the American dream. And my kiddo who is here today could not make it because her dad was in the hospital. But she's no longer my student since she had to move. They were in search of the American dream. They bought their first home in Spokane Valley. And on the first day that FAFSA opened up, she came to me and she did her FAFSA. She's applied to colleges. And I could sit here and tell you that life is all fun and nice and dandy, but whenever you see a person in their surface, you always share the lowest of lows and the highest of highs. And that is what I'm here to do with my students. So when you see them, they might look at you and be in fear. But what they tell me to tell you today is to help them out, to not judge them, to not make fun of them when you hear their accent, or to not feel as though you should have pity for them, because they're also here to have the American dream. Thank you.
Mara is my next-door neighbor at school. Our classrooms are right next to each other, and I can say they are really lucky to have her. She's got a steady stream of kids. She feeds them. She she gets them to fill out their forms. One of my students in there today, I walked in, and one of her students said, I applied to 3 colleges today. And so, and she was raised a foster kid, and she's had a really tough life. So thank you for working so hard for them. Okay, so that's kind of a small world because she's right next door. Now, this is our last storyteller of the night, and the story I want to tell before he comes up here is, so you remember Megan's story about the date she had and climbing the statue. She's telling the story about a longboarder named Dave, and our next storyteller, Daniel, says, wait a minute, I know a longboarder named Dave. And so it kind of goes on for a little bit longer. And so finally, Daniel has the courage to say, what's Dave's last name? And Megan says it. And he goes, that's my cousin. So Spokane is a small town. Okay, so this is our last story of the night. It's a very funny story. Please welcome Daniel Walters.
It's 2011, 2 days before Thanksgiving in St. Petersburg. Flurries of snow are falling on the statue of Lenin outside her apartment. and I'm in love with Megan Adney, but I haven't told her yet. I'm 25, and the sum total of women who I've said I love you to is zero, the margin of error of mom. But that's about to change. There have been 4 years of buildup to this moment. Like most love stories, it began at Lutheran summer camp. She was a camp counselor. It was infatuation at first conversation. She had it all. She had intelligence and beauty and glasses and H in the middle of her name. She read all the Harry Potter books, even the seventh one that had just come out. I thought she was amazing. She thought I was annoying. But that's basically how Jane Austen's classic novel Pride and Prejudice starts, right, guys? So I was patient and I was persistent and clever. And so I waited, years later, reconnected with her using the old devious ploy of a long-distance book club, and the next thing you know, we're on her parents' couch, and I'm holding her hand like the world's coolest fourth grader. The next 5 months are a giddy blur. It's May, and we're on a tarp in a field in Bonner's Ferry after a rainstorm, and it's night, and we're looking up at the night sky, and I ask, can I kiss you? And she says, yes, and I do, and I start laughing because it feels absurd for any one man to feel so happy. It's July, and we're watching the fireworks explode in the most romantic garbage dump in all of Shoshone County, and we're promising each other that we're never gonna run out of things to talk about like all those other boring couples we know. It's May, and we've driven up a dirt road to the top of an Idaho mountain, and we stay there until 3 a.m., sharing both a bottle of huckleberry wine and the feeling that in that moment we're the only two people left in the world. We were 2011's it couple, and it seemed like nothing could stop us. Nothing except perhaps America's greatest geopolitical foe, Russia. She was going to be teaching in Russia for 9 months. And we knew, of course, that Russian winters had defeated Napoleon and defeated Hitler. But she was slightly taller than Napoleon, and I was slightly more easygoing than Hitler. And so we promised each other that we'd be different. We would dig in, survive the long winter. It's September. She's gone. And if the stakes couldn't be any higher, I realize that I'm in love with Megan Adney. It's like those patterns that when you stare at them cross-eyed long enough, all of a sudden a 3D image pops out. And it's real and profound and beautiful, and you can't wait to tell someone. But I wasn't going to tell her I love you on Skype. It's my first time, and I wanted it to be special. I wanted it to be the sort of story that I could tell a half dozen years later before an enraptured crowd of hundreds. It's November, and I'm flying across the ocean, 25 hours running through the plan in my head. There's a bridge over the Neva River that opens up to allow ships to pass at night. We would go there, and I'd hold her hand, and as the bridge opened, I would say, I love you, symbolizing, of course, our hearts opening up to allow our relationship to glide through in the moonlit waters of trust and affection. Obviously. So I land, and for the first 2 days, it's just all kissing. Brief breaks for applying chapstick. That's it. And in one of those moments, as we come up for air, I ask her that question, beloved by journalists and acting coaches and hostage negotiators. What do you want? And then she says it. I love you. Bam! I love you too. No hesitation. Forget about the bridge. To hell with the Neva River. I was like Usain Bolt out of the blocks. I love you too. And there's a moment and neither of us say anything. And I feel like Cinderella wearing the fairy godmother dress and I'm dancing with Prince Charles. Actually, let's go with a manlier metaphor. I'm Indiana Jones And I've hacked through the jungle and discovered the temple and disarmed the traps. And I'm here standing with the golden idol held aloft in my hand. And as I'm staring into her emerald eyes, triumphant, she makes a clarification. No, I said, all of you. All of you. I love you. All of you. I love you. All of you. I'd asked what she wanted. She said, all of me. It was a sickening sensation in my stomach that I realized that she had been trying to be sexy. Which, for the record, I generally appreciate. But it's a little like those birthday cards that you get that trick you into thinking that it's a winning lottery ticket, but when you open it up, it's actually a $25 gift certificate to Red Robin. Now, anyone who knows me knows that I love Red Robin. I love bonsai burgers and a limited steak fries, but I thought I was gonna be a millionaire. And she can see this play across my face. And she knows what's happened, and she says, oh no, you probably wanted to tell me for the first time when the bridge went up with the Neva River with a symbolism of trust and affection. She guessed it, because she knows me, and that's why I love her. And then she offers what she feels is the kindness. You can take it back. But of course I can't take it back any more than you can shove shrapnel back into a grenade. And I don't want to take it back. Because what I want is I want her to hear her say what I thought I heard her say. But she can't. Because she holds those three words as sacred as I do. Which is why I love her. For her, they're like a forbidden magic incantation. They're avra-kedavra. They're the feeling of commitment. It's a promise like an engagement ring without the blood diamond. And she is honest, which is why I love her. And so she can't say that at that point. And at that point, I didn't realize it would sting that much. I thought it was a possibility. But the thing is that I love you isn't a three-word solo. It's a seven-word duet. It's a call and response. It's I love you. So you guys can say it. And if you say it and you don't hear anything back, it's like if you're in the pool and you say Marco and no one else says Polo, then you're just floating there blind and cold and alone. There's a weight. She likes me still, but there's a weight. There's a difference in weight between like and love, like the difference in weight between a golden idol and a bag of sand. There's a click, and the podium the idol's on begins to shift. There's a whirring of ancient machinery. The pillars begin to crumble. Stones begin to fall. The ceiling begins to collapse, and the whole thing begins to fall apart. We start fighting about the littlest things, the water on the bathroom floor and the beard hair in the sink and subway directions and cooking techniques. There's poison darts zipping past my face and axes flying from the ceiling and snakes coming out of the walls. Protests are beginning to pop up all across Russia. And I don't speak Russian, so I don't know what they're saying, but I'm pretty sure it's, Megan, give Daniel a chance. Is good man, not perfect, but tries. And so, but despite the will, the popular will of the Russian people, our kisses begin to grow colder and shorter. Our silences grow longer and heavier, almost like we're running out of things to talk about. There's one more topic left, of course. Over a plate of beef stroganoff in Moscow, with the care and carefully considered words and kindness of a hospice nurse, she explains to me that while she still has feelings for me, those feelings are fading. The clock strikes midnight. The gown turns back into rags. The horses turn back into mice. The carriage turns into a giant stone boulder of dread, chasing me through the streets of Nevsky Prospect. It's December. We finally get to the bridge over the Neva River. And we stay there, shivering until 3 a.m. We don't hold hands. There's no huckleberry wine. And the bridge never opens. Partly that's because the bridges stop opening in November and December, and partly because symbolism is a cruel and feckless god who works both ways. We have one last fight before we go. On the surface, it's a fight about missing the bus to the airport, but underneath, it's a fact that there's a pit opening up, and it's 12 time zones and 5,000 miles and three words wide, and the door is closing, and I'm standing on one side and she's standing on the other, and I've thrown her the idol and I'm begging with her to throw me the whip. But she's like, look, the idol's sweet and everything, but I just don't feel whip ready. And so I leap and I fall, and the plane ride home gets changed from luxurious Lufthansa to United. Putin crushes the protests as easily as Hillary Clinton's election dreams. I come back home to a cold and dark apartment without even a statue of Lenin out front. I write humorous captions in all the photos from the trip, and they deeply offend her religious family. I send her on Skype, I send her an emoticon of a heart, and she sends back the emoticon of a squirrel. And that summed it up. I was in love with her, and she was in squirrel with me. But I was patient, and I was persistent, and I was clever, and she came back to Spokane, and we kept dating, we had more conversation, we reconnected, and 2.5 years later, not only did she say, I love you, she said, yes, I will marry you. Not to me, to be clear. It's like you guys haven't been following this at all. To a brawny University of Missoula forestry major that she called the mountain man. Because that's the thing. No matter how much you feel that the universe has promised you a love story with a happy ending worthy of a fairy tale or a Spielberg movie, no matter how patient or persistent or clever you are, no matter how much you idolize her, you can't always change a squirrel to a heart. But you can trick yourself to thinking you did. Because for years, I was in love with Megan Adney. And for one priceless fool of a misunderstood second, I truly believed she was in love with me. All of me. Спасибо, до свидания.
Can you please join me in giving a hand to all the storytellers?
We just heard Daniel Walters of Inlander fame. Tonight we opened with Jennifer Hawkins, then heard from Wara Ruiz. That concludes the three episodes of The Bookshelf, which comprise the entire content of the Pivot event, which took place at the Washington Cracker Building on November 2nd. These Pivot stories may all be heard as podcasts at kpbx.org. Pivot, with schedules and information on involvement, can be reached at pivotspokane.com. Tomorrow on The Bookshelf, StoryCorps. Let's all be recording our relatives and our families this holiday season.